You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au. This translates to, we acknowledge the Kaurna people. They are the landowners from a long time ago. We recognize the Kaurna people are still alive. The territory of these Kaurna plains is exclusively Kaurna land. Just find some stillness within so that we can hear these opening words in your deeper understanding. For every time we let our vulnerable selves be known, we light this chalice. For every time we recognize vulnerability in another, we light this chalice. For every time we see another in pain and we turn away, or worse, deny it, we light this chalice. For every time we risk offering care to another, we light this chalice. Well, good morning and welcome to this service of worship. My name is Rob McPherson, the minister of this church, and I welcome you on behalf of generations of Unitarians who've worshiped in similar gatherings since 1854. We are fortunate in South Australia to be able to have church services at all, and so it's important that we comply with SA health conditions. Jenny Warner is our COVID marshal today. If she gives you any direction today, please comply. I'd also like to remind you that you make sure that you've signed in, as a record of attendance is mandatory. Now, members of the church don't need to leave their contact details when they sign in, but non-members absolutely need to so that we can comply with health regulations. That is about social responsibility. That is our social responsibility to one another. But I'd also like to remind you of the highly individualistic ethos of this place, this church. We are a spiritual community that encourages all of you to find, fashion, and follow your own spiritual path in freedom and responsibility. Any path that helps you see more clearly, love more abundantly, and work toward a better world for all.
The principle of compassion lies at the heart of all religious, ethical, and spiritual traditions, calling us always to treat all others as we wish to be treated ourselves. Compassion impels us to work tirelessly to alleviate the suffering of our fellow creatures, to dethrone ourselves from the centre of our world and put another there, and to honour the inviolable sanctity of every single human being, treating everybody without exception with absolute justice, equity, and respect. It is also necessary in both public and private life to refrain consistently and emphatically from inflicting pain, to act or speak violently out of spite, chauvinism, or self-interest, to impoverish, exploit, or deny the basic rights of anybody, and to incite hatred by denigrating others, even our enemies, is a denial of our common humanity. We acknowledge that we have failed to live compassionately and that some have even increased the sum of human misery in the name of religion. We therefore call upon all men and women to restore compassion to the centre of morality and religion, to return to the ancient principle that any interpretation of scripture that breeds violence, hatred, or disdain is illegitimate, to ensure that youth are given accurate and respectful information about other traditions, religions, and cultures, to encourage a positive appreciation of cultural and religious diversity, to cultivate an informed empathy with the suffering of all human beings, even those regarded as enemies. We urgently need to make compassion a clear, luminous, and dynamic force in our polarized world, rooted in a principled determination to transcend selfishness. Compassion can break down political, dogmatic, ideological, and religious boundaries. Born of our deep interdependence, compassion is essential to human relationships and to a fulfilled humanity. It is the path to enlightenment and indispensable to the creation of a just economy and a peaceful global community.
Thanks, Richard. So that's the Charter for Compassion. A few years back in this church, I ran a couple of religious education courses. They're not called religious education courses anymore. They're called adult enrichment. Sounds less condescending, I guess. Based on Karen Armstrong's book, 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life. So we did a couple of goes at that. It is a great book, full of multi-faith wisdom, psychological scholarship, common sense, spiritual practice, and it will give you a stepped program to make yourself a more compassionate person. Of course, you've got to want it first, and to want it might mean that you recognize a compassion deficit in your own life, and you know, not many people are willing to admit that. My experience of Unitarians is that we can lack a little humility in this regard. We assume that having rejected mean religious dogmatics, we automatically stand with love. Would 'twere that 'twere so simple. As if a commitment to predicating your life on compassion required no facing your own wild inner demons, no hard rewiring of your head, no disciplined change to just doing whatever the hell comes naturally. Love is the whole of religious law, as they say. The rest is commentary. If living out of love is not what you want, for yourself at least, what are you doing in a religion? Seems a fair question. The Charter for Compassion, Richard read, grew out of a wave of popular response to Armstrong's work, and this charter bears careful rereading at your leisure. I'm pretty sure those of you who took the adult enrichment courses have put their names to affirming it, and our church as an institution have affirmed it. But have you? And will you affirm it, what you heard? If you have not affirmed the Charter for Compassion, please have a look with a view to doing so. If you have reservations about doing so, I'd love to know what they are. Please email them to me. By the end of 2020, I'd like to see the name of every single church member on that charter, or have heard your reasons why you will not affirm it. My own decision to move into professional ministry late in life was, in fact, a decision to put compassion at the center of how I live, come what may, or try to, or at least, by entering ministry, create a kind of structure around myself that would suppress the wild things in me and to encourage my better self to show up more regularly. My default setting was not compassion. Therefore, I was not a religious person per se. But like many boomers of my generation, I thought life was compassion deficit. It's not generational. It's not a generational thing. I grew up much like the kids I work with now. And the kids I work with now are a lot like I was 50 years ago. My parents worked. I went to school. I played sports, which was not because I wanted to, but because I was doing my damnedest to fit into the peer group I was given. And experiencing, therefore, like the kids I see today, the ordinary hurts and disappointments that come from trying to be liked, or at least not shunned by my peers. There was this one kid who was easily the most popular kid in my class and my team, and his name was Freddie Wetzelberger Jr. That's not an easy name to forget, is it? Freddie Wetzelberger Jr. had it all. Freddie Wetzelberger was smart, funny, great at all sports, a real leader. And being boys, we all play up to the strongest, so we all tried to be like Freddie Wetzelberger. He and I were on the local Woodlawn baseball team, and his father, Freddie Wetzelberger Sr., because that's the kind of name you want to pass on, was the coach. Freddie Wetzelberger Jr. was our best player. He could do everything. He could hit. He could field. He could run like a sprinter. He could throw like lightning. I couldn't hit water if I fell out of a boat. And I was not especially fast either. I could pitch some reasonably accurately. I had a fastball, a not-so-fastball, and a curve that sometimes, you know, didn't curve. So when I wasn't pitching, Freddie Wetzelberger's dad put me in the outfield where the less good players go. But see, I never learned from a baseball-playing dad like Freddie Wetzelberger Jr. did. My dad's sport was gridiron, which I struggled at too, but my dad kindly volunteered to be an assistant coach on the team so he could make sure I got some game time. Playing on this team gave me an early lesson about compassion and why we find it hard or unnatural at times. One day, my dad and I were standing on the sidelines and my team was up batting, and Freddie Wetzelberger Jr., of course, up at bat, got a hit, safe at first. Freddie's father was on the third baseline, gave him the sign to steal second base, which is something like that. So when their pitcher went into his windup, Freddie Wetzelberger took off like the wind. But what Freddie Wetzelberger and Freddie Wetzelberger's dad didn't know was that the other team had this new catcher with an arm like a howitzer. Catcher took the pitch, stood up, threw a bullet to second base. Freddie slid for all he was worth right into the waiting mitt of the second baseman. The ump cried, "You're out!" Well, we were stunned. Freddie Wetzelberger had never been caught out before. And Freddie got up, dusted himself off, and fell apart. I mean, burst into, imagine the ugliest sobbing crying you can think of. Tears, snot, spit, blubbering, you know, that kind of a thing. Real ugly cry. We had never seen Freddie cry before. We'd never seen anybody cry so publicly. He sobbed like that as he walked back to the bench right by his father, the coach, who stood there silent, arms folded, expressionless. Nobody said anything. Freddie didn't play the rest of the game. And we won anyway. But it didn't feel like it, somehow. We were all upset by Freddie's crying jag. I know I was. We were driving home. Dad and I were quiet in the car, but finally I couldn't contain my bewilderment any longer. I said, "Dad, what happened? Why did Freddie cry so hard? Freddie never cries, and just for getting thrown out at second, and we still won." My dad lit another cigarette, stared at the traffic, and he said quietly to me, "Son, that's because Freddie Wetzelberger knows when he gets home, his old man's going to beat the hell out of him for that. How do you think Freddie Wetzelberger got so good at baseball?" There's a logic to corporal punishment I've never understood. Maybe you can explain it to me. A kid does something an adult doesn't like. The adult physically assaults the kid, and the kid gets better, somehow, magically. Now, my dad was a normal 50s dad, not well-educated, a returned soldier, strong as an ox. But he's not the kind of dad I always wanted, not educated, returned soldier factor. I would have preferred a smart, rich, and connected father. But I suspect I was not the kind of son he always wanted either. I was studious and quiet and not a natural athlete, but all my life, he never laid a hand on me in anger. And he had a certain wisdom, born, I guess, of growing up hard and poor in the Great Depression, seeing some god-awful bloody massacres in the war, and the reward for all that was a life of struggle, four kids, a mortgage, and a job he hated, for life. He said to me, "You see, Freddie Wetzelberger's dad beats him over things like baseball games because that's probably what Freddie Wetzelberger's father got from his dad and his dad's dad before him. And the beat goes on. The hits just keep on coming. Your friend, Freddie Wetzelberger," Dad said, "is a jerk. His dad is a jerk. And Freddie Wetzelberger will probably grow up and have a bunch of jerk kids and beat them too." Well, I couldn't understand then that you could see someone weaker and in misery and still be cruel to them. We wonder, do we not, I know I do, about man's inhumanity to man and whether that first principle stuff about the inherent worth and dignity of every person is true or just a fond hope. The kids I see now are witness 24/7 to merciless bullying, of course, in fictional movies and games, of course, but also, most disappointingly, from adult role models in public life, from policies that amount to little more than callous thuggery. And we ask, where do they learn it from? Where does this cancer come from? Where indeed? If coarse language offends you, or if you don't think it appropriate to a pulpit, stop your ears right now. I know this one from memory. This Be the Verse by Philip Larkin. They fuck you up, your mom and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. They give you all the faults they had and add some extra just for you. But they were fucked up in their turn by fools in old-style hats and coats who half the time were soppy stern and half at one another's throats. Man hands on misery to man. It deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as quickly as you can and don't have any kids yourself. Man hands on misery to man. Where else do the kids I see today learn cruelty and bullying? From adult models is where. I know many will say, well, you know, it was common practice for most of human history. And, you know, no, certain cultures do discipline kids corporally, and we need to be tolerant of. I think you're getting real bewildered here. A practice may be common and still be morally objectionable. Maybe when the day comes, generations from now, when assaulting children is regarded the way we now regard all other forms of assault, that cruelty too will disappear from our species, like slavery, like the subjugation of women. And we will become that compassionate race we clearly want to be. I see a lot of kids that have been called into being by parents. What links them in time is an instant of blind passion, but the awesome act of calling a soul out of non-being into this bugger of an earth, and then to offer them anything but compassion. If you're going to have them, they have to learn compassion from you, and if you haven't got it to give, maybe Larkin's right, best you never bring them here. For now, such abuse exists, ironically, because of the very neurology that makes us human. Stay with me on this. Back in the car with my dad, I was trying to understand a parent beating a child that he knew, or he himself was beaten. I said to my dad, look, all right, if Freddie Wetzelberger's dad was beat up, like you say, he would know what that feels like. So why would he do it? Then again, to his own son. My father threw a cigarette out the window, pulled the car over, and said, look, son, you might not understand this. When you see somebody hurting, even if it's your own flesh and blood, you're kind of looking in a mirror. You see your own pain in them, and either you feel your own pain all over again, which is hard, or you break that mirror so you don't see it anymore. Breaking the mirror is just easier for some. For a guy without a college education, my old man was actually onto some sound Buddhist wisdom and modern psychology. Thanks to our mirror neurons, we can recognize ourselves in others. And since everyone experiences suffering, thank you, Buddha, suffering in others is a mirror for our own. So what we're really experiencing when we see others suffer is a struggle with ourselves, with our own suffering, an inner conflict, to face it by offering compassion or to deny it, destroy it, make it go away. Only one of those two ways leads to healing our own pain. Guess which? There are only really two choices about the suffering of others. To recognize it and feeling it yourself, only seek to make it disappear, or to recognize it and feeling it yourself, go beyond your own pain to offer compassion to the other. Guess which one is better for you? During Freddie Wetzelberger's breakdown, I could see in his tears and sobbing the times I'd wept, brokenhearted, terrified, or ashamed. And all I could think at that game was, if I go over and comfort him, what will happen to me? Will I be mocked? Will I be thought weak? What I could have thought was, if I don't go and comfort him, what will happen to him? The charter speaks of dethroning ourselves from the center of our lives and placing another there. 50 years later, reading in Armstrong's book, The 11th Step of Recognition, seeing one's own suffering in others, brought that day, that awful day of recognition, freshly to my mind. Freddie Wetzelberger's Now I understand terror, my own craven response, and my father's simple wisdom. There's an epilogue to this story. When social media got started about 12 years ago, I jumped on, of course, because I was still a media studies lecturer, and I ran across Freddie Wetzelberger on Facebook. In his pictures was his son, Freddie Wetzelberger III, holding a baseball trophy. But I saw in Freddie Wetzelberger III a look in the eyes that I recognized. Freddie Wetzelberger Sr., the coach's look, hard, cold, pitiless. Man hands on misery to man. The beat goes on. Could I have made a difference to Freddie Wetzelberger back then? I don't know. All I do know is I didn't even try, because I didn't like what I saw in the mirror he was for me that day. Friends, do not wait. Make the choice to do whatever you have to do to put compassion at the center of your life and practice. I don't recommend going into ministry necessarily. There are easier ways. Church or no church, sign it, mean it, do it before you stack up any more regrets about what you could have done but didn't, or before, God forbid, any more mirrors get broken. It's bad luck, I'm told. Let me offer you this blessing before we depart. May we remember that when I say your life matters, that is where compassion begins. When I open the door to greet you, that is where hospitality begins. When I venture out to bring you to shelter, that is where love begins. When I risk my comfort to ease your suffering, when I act against hatred, violence, and injustice, that is where courage begins. When we experience the fullness of each other because of our shared humanity, because of our differences, that is where holy gratitude begins. May this church be a place that is not complete until all are welcome and loved. Amen. Have a great week.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing UnitarianSA@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.